Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman who is bleary from watching so much World Cup soccer, Stafford Pomieri.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, Stafford, what I want to understand is how you're watching all these World Cup games since they seem to happen during the workday.
I actually haven't seen a single World Cup game. I watched part of Nigeria versus Argentina. Were they playing Argentina? I think it was Argentina, which was before the USA England Cup game. Mm-hmm. And I thought about going. There was a public viewing in D.C. at DuPont Circle. Mm-hmm. It was apparently, according to Janie, who went, a big sweaty mess.
It was fantastic.
I stayed in my air-conditioned apartment.
See, World Cup is something you really need to watch with other people.
It's a big community event. You know, it was really exciting.
Not when it's 100 degrees outside.
You know what we should do? You know, I think that for most people, listening to the Education Gadfly Show, though, is a very solitary thing. You know, you put on your headphones or you're there at your computer. We should have listening parties that we organize sometime. Wouldn't that be great? How about at big conferences? At the Charter Conference, we could have a big...
Listen to the podcast together.
Yeah, I think that could be fun.
I think that would really add depth to our understanding of the topics discussed.
Yes. Although we don't really give people much opportunity to cheer or to boo. We could add that in. That would be... interactive. Maybe we'll work on that.
Okay. Applause.
Rick is still in Georgia.
The country.
The country. Doing Lord knows what. But I haven't heard from him lately.
He emailed me this morning.
Oh, good. Okay. Glad.
He's
still
alive.
On the radar screen. Okay. Good. Excellent. Is he having a good time? Is he hot tubbing every night? Do we know much about
I cannot comment on the hot tubbing, but he is having a good time.
I would bet that Rick has been finding a hot tub to hang out in. But that's just my suspicion. But we can't just, you know, mix away. We've got to get some work done here. We've got a lot to cover. We're going to play part in the Gadfly. We're going to do Research Minute. We're going to rate that reform. Let's get going, Janie. Let's do part in the Gadfly.
According to the New York Times, cheating on standardized tests has turned rampant. The main perpetrators, however, are not students, but teachers who feel pressured by increasing importance of test scores to job security and compensation. Is this an argument against testing?
No.
And that's Stafford's quick answer. Look, I want to question the very premise here. Although I thought I was right. Jenny asked this correctly. According to the New York Times, cheating has turned rampant.
I wrote the question, so yes.
You're not supposed to admit that.
I apologize.
All right.
But I will edit it out.
But, you know, others, including Alexander Rousseau, who sometimes we give a hard time to, has pointed out, and I think this is fair, that this is one of these classic trend stories in a newspaper. There's no real data, just anecdotes. But it paints the picture that this is suddenly this big national trend that's happening, and it's new and it's dangerous. We really don't know. We don't know if if cheating on these tests is any greater now than it was before or how widespread it is. But, you know, Stafford, let's assume that it does happen. It happens in some places. So what's the right response to that?
The right response is that, I don't know what the right response is, that it's going to happen and we just need to be more careful about putting in safeguards, make sure it doesn't happen, or we need to move to a more online test-based system where we have fewer people actually interfacing with the tests and less room for tampering.
So you mean because then you wouldn't have the teacher's ability to pick up the tests and to redo them after the fact.
Right.
Yeah, look, I mean, so there are some technical things. We have to expect that there will be bad apples out there. They will cheat. And so we need to guard against that. You got to think about test security. And you got to be smart about how that works. And so, yeah, having a system where the teachers go around and pick up the tests after the fact and can hang out with those exams for hours on end, probably not a good way to go in this era of high-stakes testing. But, hey, you know, in all kinds of sectors, we have this kind of same issue, that there are stakes, and therefore we've got to make sure the rules are fair and enforced. Mm-hmm. Same thing here. It doesn't mean we throw out all the tests. Okay, Janie, topic number two.
The Wall Street Journal reports that corporate sponsorship of schools is on the rise. From being adopted by a local church to advertising for local businesses on the school marquee, schools are looking for new ways to fill budget holes. Should we be worried?
No, I don't think so. There are so many other ways that we could be filling these budget holes, and I think we should commend schools for their industrious thinking processes here to try to go to the local community and get some extra help. And I mean, honestly, advertising in schools is not that new of an issue or that big of a deal.
Well, let's be, all right, there's some pros and cons to Stafford. All right, so sure. Like, for example, I don't mind if they advertise on the side of a school bus, just like we do on the side of city buses, and if that is targeted at non-kid, at adults, so not the school kids themselves, it's on the outside of the bus. Yeah, but it's a little bit different if we've got advertising, say, in school hallways as they walk down the halls. There's certainly questions about what is okay to be advertised. And this article points out that there are some instances where churches are adopting schools, and that's giving them access to, you know, do their own forms of advertising to try to get kids to come into their churches, perhaps, and that starts to cross some.
I agree with you on the churches example, though that particular story that they were talking about in the Wall Street Journal, the families that they got access to gave the school permission to share their information with the church. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't as if the school sort of like shared the entire parent list of the student body with the church. But yes, there are definitely some issues there, but I think if handled correctly, this shouldn't have to be a problem at all.
You know, I like this better than some other ideas, like going to a four-day week. I did a Fox and Friends show last week arguing against a four-day week, and I guess I made some people angry because I got some feedback from folks that I was arguing against what is a very innovative approach. I made the point that, look, if you're a parent, this is a terrible idea. I mean, what are you supposed to do if you're a working parent? All of a sudden you have to find childcare one day a week for your kid. Like, how is that supposed to work? And the superintendent of a school district in Georgia that does this said, you know, our mission is education. It is not childcare.
That's true. And as we move away from seat time towards learning time, she's got a point.
I don't know. I think that the public paying the bill still expects schools to play that custodial role. Just like, you know, transportation's not their mission either, but I don't think parents would be real happy if all of a sudden the school bus stopped coming.
Actually, students in New York City are protesting the fact that Bloomberg is about to cut, I think it's Bloomberg, not Klein. Well, I guess they are one in the same some senses, but they're going to cut the free Metro cards that students get to take to schools wherever they are, staging like a walkout or something last Friday, all the students.
Okay, topic number three, Janie.
Should reformers be more laudatory about courageous union leaders?
Well, that's an interesting question, James. So we'll give you a little inside scoop here, Gadfly listeners. So Secretary of Education Arne Duncan was at our Board of Trustees meeting last week. He came for a visit, which was very nice of him to do. And one of our trustees asked him a great question, which was about, you know, was there any great disappointment that he had in his first year and a half, especially from reformers? And he made the point that he was disappointed that so many reformers go out to really bash teacher unions at all costs, and haven't stopped to praise the handful of union leaders that have really been courageous, been willing to sign contracts that are far-reaching or to sign on to Race to the Top deals that are pretty bold. And he thinks that the reformers are wrong, and I think that includes us, that we tend to just treat unions as monolithic. What do you think, Stafford? Is there some truth to that? Is that a good case? There's, like, you know, courageous leaders out there that deserve praise?
I think there is. I think there is a point there, and I think part of it is that reformers tend to hold a lot of these reforms to the ideal of how we would like a compensation to work, or a compensation system to work, or an evaluation system to work, or whatever, and we discount the fact that getting that perfect system right on the first go is probably unrealistic. And so there are some of these union leaders who are doing these baby steps. In New Haven, for example, the union leader was very key to getting their new contract signed, and the new contract has a new evaluation system in it. And no, the evaluation system is not perfect, but it is miles better than what they used to have. So yeah, we can blast them for not, you know, creating a perfect evaluation system. But at the same time, without the union support, they wouldn't have an evaluation system at all. And heretofore, they were not really evaluating teachers at all. So I'm glad.
So the point is that there are some places where we can say, hey, unions are moving in the right direction. They're signing on to some stuff that even a few years ago would have been completely taboo.
Mm-hmm.
And we should praise them for that. And in fact, you and Checker in this week's Gadfly editorial are doing so.
Yes, we are.
Good for you. Okay. Okay, well, that is all the time we have now for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good.
So what you got served up for us today?
What do I have this week? Well, it's kind of like a duo here. You remember last week I talked about the TAP pay for performance evaluation.
Yes.
This week we've
got
this
was in Chicago.
This was in Chicago, and this week we have another one. This is Denver's ProComp, which is most folks know Denver ProComp. It was sort of the first flagship sort of one of these programs. So anyway, we're looking at that evaluation this week. Just to give you a little background on ProComp, it basically layers on bonuses to the teacher's base salary for things like a master's degree or professional development, taking on extra responsibilities, working at a high-need school. So it's kind of a layering program.
And performance? There's a performance piece?
And there's a performance piece, okay. Yes. I forgot that part, which is presumably the most important one. The program was initially piloted in 1999. It became mandatory in 2006. So analysts examined 8 years of achievement data going back from 2001 through 2009. They found that student growth steadily increased during this time in both math and reading. So teachers hired post-ProComp, when it was mandatory, demonstrate greater gains than those hired prior to the program, and the differences persist through at least 3 years. So, in other words, there's evidence that ProComp changes the composition of the teaching force. Schools with greater rates of ProComp participation also have higher rates of retention. That said, this design is not experimental like the TAP study last week, so it's not as robust. It's particularly prone to selection bias and other confounding variables, meaning that a bunch of other stuff was going on during the same time, and we can't really parse out the effects and say this was due to ProComp.
Who did the study, Amy?
It was a university. It wasn't a household name. It was a university researcher at a local university.
I didn't mean to stump you with that one.
I know.
So this is interesting. I mean, this was exactly what we talked about last week, mm-hmm. was that the TAP program in Chicago did not show gains in achievement, mm-hmm. but we weren't all that surprised by that because it hadn't been in place all that long. And what we said, the real point of performance pay is to recruit different kinds of people into teaching in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So these people coming into Denver now seem to be what, more effective than the people that were already there?
That's the implication.
And isn't it tough to figure this out? Because if a lot of those teachers are brand new teachers, mm-hmm. they're going to get dramatically better in the first year or two.
That's
just
right.
From getting.
Yeah, so
right.
I mean, that's why, I mean, honestly, I could have gone on and on about the limitations of the design because a lot of these things just weren't accounted for. And it's every time we see an experimental study, 9 times out of 10, it's not going to have any effect. And then you get these lesser kind of evaluations and they show effect. And anyway, and they're very, they admit this is early, this is observational, it's not experimental. They try to do some matching, mm-hmm. Of teachers who had opted in and then teachers who, were mandatory in. And I mean, they did a bunch of different sort of comparison groups, but I think it's intriguing enough to warrant further study. I know mm-hmm. we hate when we say that, but I think we saw the trends in both reading and math. Mm-hmm. We saw them over a period of time, so it's robust enough to think something's going on.
I have to say, I'm just worried that as people that I generally support performance pay because of this reason of maybe attracting a different kind of person into education in the first mm-hmm. place, you got to get it right. But this idea that we're going to see these big gains in achievement, I just mm-hmm. think that we're setting ourselves up for failure. Same way with charter schools, I think we oversold that as we're going to see these huge gains
right.
in achievement. Whereas, hey, even if achievement doesn't get dramatically better in these schools, but parents have choices that they like better and that, there's a value there. It's not enough. I mean, we definitely mm-hmm. need to get some reforms that are getting big gains in achievement. But, same thing with merit pay. Like, if it just makes sense, if teachers like it, if morale is better when
That's
you are
right.
rewarding performance. And, I mean, a lot of these things are such intangibles. Whether you can link that to achievement.
Yeah, and lots of times in the interview data you'll see, or survey data you'll see teachers say, well, it made me feel like a professional, and it kind of gets at that cultural and, self-efficacy stuff that's mm-hmm. so hard to measure, which may be at play here as well.
Yeah, but we can't assume that just paying teachers more money or offering them more money is going to make them, radically wake up one day and have a whole new teaching style or figure out, the silver bullet to how to make
right.
that
Right, but that's
Johnny
the whole point.
Is
the hope right. is that, though, a different kind of person comes into teaching
right.
first place because they say, hey, this is a profession now that values excellence and performance. And
but I think the other line of reasoning that merit pay will inspire teachers to work harder or learn new things or whatever, I think that's still out there. And I think it's,
yeah.
I mean, it's falling by the wayside more, but
yeah.
at least 5 years ago, that was a lot of the reason.
No,
for
that's fair. All right, okay. Amber, so what is the song that goes along
so
with this?
So since Denver teachers are getting extra pay, we have Payday by Elvis Costello.
Okay, Janie, welcome back to the show. It is time for us to rate that reform. All right, Janie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Back in the Rate That Reform chair once
again. About, you know, she's just 5 minutes since I was, you know, in the seat.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I was going to say the number of weeks you've been sitting in that chair.
That's true. That is true. I've been here for quite some time now.
You have.
You know, but now next week we have a special show. It is Andy Smirik's going away show on the Education
Gadfly
show.
And I will be back in that seat. So
be ready for that, everybody. This is going to be a special one. Our send-off to Andy before he goes to New Jersey. Our last chance to try to bribe him before he's a public official. Okay, Janie, what are we rating this week?
We're rating a similar reform as, you know, the one we were talking about earlier with the buses and corporate sponsorship. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if you like this one any better than that one.
Okay.
Alabama's State Superintendent Joe Morgan has faced some tough budgetary issues recently. The economic downturn aside, Alabama state education tax revenues have dipped due to the Gulf oil spill. Tourism and fishing have dwindled, affecting sales, income, and utility taxes that typically fund the public education system. So what does Superintendent Joe Morgan intend to do? Lay off teachers, cut programs, move to a four-day week? No, he plans to send British Petroleum, or BP, the company responsible for the spill, a big fat invoice for the money loss incurred by the state education system.
I love it!
To quote Morgan, "This oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is wreaking havoc on our environment and Gulf Coast economy. We cannot allow it to undermine our public schools by reducing the very tax receipts that pay our teachers' salaries and help our classrooms keep the learning environment alive." End quote. If BP doesn't pay up, Morgan plans to sue the corporation for the amount on behalf of Alabama's public school students. So I admit, I'm a fan of him in this instance, kind of for the same reason that you were listing before, Mike. You know, he's trying to think outside of the box and attempt a budget crisis. His try-anything mentality is kind of refreshing in a system that normally turns to the same, you know, tried-and-failed efforts over and over, like seniority-based layoffs that, you know, in the end just wind up harming students.
I do believe that was my point of view, not Mike's.
Oh, well, sorry. So, you know, maybe the CEO of BP will end up ignoring Morgan. You know, he's probably busy watching the president tonight. And maybe, you know, the courts will throw out his lawsuit. But in the end, you know, if you don't ask, you don't get. And so I like Morgan's gumption, and I give the reform a B.
Nice. You know what? I think this is a great idea. I mean, I feel for the guy, and I feel for the states down there. I mean, look, this is such a depressing thing happening down there in the Gulf. I literally cannot look at the newspapers or watch the news. It's just, you know, I feel like all this effort. We've got school children all over America trying, you know, doing things to save the environment and to recycle and da-da-da. And then something like this happens, and you're, it's very depressing.
The pictures are terrible.
But this, you know, look, I think this is somewhat fair. I mean, I think, you know, if BP is responsible for this, they need to be responsible for all the different side effects of this, too. And I don't think it's such a ridiculous idea.
Yeah, I mean, school budgets are based on expected income. And if your income isn't there for a particularly large reason, then, you know,
I do have to ask is about the sector, the tourism sector in Alabama. Now, I mean, I'm going to the Rangers here, I know, but do you know anybody who's ever gone on a vacation to Alabama?
Hey, Huntsville, Alabama, space camp. Who doesn't go to space camp?
Oh, okay. All right. Good point.
I have gone to space camp.
All right.
I'm a little biased. My mom's a space camp counselor.
No way. Yeah. Can she get us in special deals?
I'll ask. I'll check with her.
I could be the Fordham Retreat.
That would be great.
All right. Space camp. But I can't believe the state is really raking in that much money just from space camp alone. So what else?
I mean, isn't the Gulf Coast, you know, there's beaches, I assume.
Mm-hmm. yeah, I got nothing. I'm sure Alabama is a very nice place to visit, but I got nothing.
All right. Well, all you fans of ours from Alabama, you can send your hate mail to Janie at
jscott@alabama.com.
She loves Alabama. All right. Nicely done. Nicely played. And that is all the time we've got for this week. So, again, join us next week for Andy Smirik's Going Away Show. Until then.
I'm Stafford Palmieri.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.